Today, it's easy to take the lush greenery, bucolic ponds, and rolling hills of Central Park for granted. In the 19th century, architect Frederick Law Olmsted transformed an 843-acre wasteland into a public green space unlike any other the world had seen. But during the 1960s and 70s, the park entered into a period of serious decline, plagued by crime and vandalism resulting from decades of neglect. Elizabeth Barlow Rogers, author and president of the Foundation for Landscape Studies, is known as the woman who saved Central Park. In her new book, titled Saving Central Park, she tells the story of how she was able to organize its rescue at a pivotal moment in the city's history and restore it to the beautiful landmark it is today. Saving Central Park is published by Knopf, and I'm happy that it's brought Elizabeth Barlow Rogers to our show. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So you grew up in San Antonio, Texas, yes? What brought you to New York in the 60s?
Well, I went away to college, and I married my college boyfriend from Yale, and then I studied city planning while he was studying law, and open space planning was my particular field of interest. So when he took his first job with a law firm in New York, I began as a volunteer with a park organization. So I've been a proponent of parks, all the city's parks, from the very beginning. And then I did decide to write a book on Frederick Law Olmsted. And that led to a job with some summer interns who were just kids, right off the streets of New York. And what I knew about Olmsted and what I knew about handling a summer intern program were two very different things. But that was the beginning.
Were you drawn to parks and gardens as a child?
I was drawn to nature as a child.
Yeah. So what are your earliest memories of Central Park as a young woman in the 60s? Do you remember your first encounters with it?
Well, if you're a mom and you have children, of course, you go to Central Park. So I took my daughter and then later my son. They're 14 years apart. So she was already six when I moved to New York. And then when he was born, he was a toddler. And we went to the playgrounds, but we also climbed those really wonderful Manhattan schist outcrops in Central Park.
So fun, made for climbing. So by the time you established the Central Park Conservancy in 1980, what kind of shape was the park in?
Well, my preliminary work was with the Central Park Task Force. This was holding a candle in the darkness in these really dire days when the New York City was in fiscal crisis and when it was near ruin, the park. And then after Mayor Koch was elected, he appointed his first park commissioner, Gordon Davis. And Gordon saw what I was trying to do, and with the vision of a plan to restore Central Park, he said, okay, let's create a job for you within the administration. And so we adopted the title Administrator of Central Park. I was very proud of my new title, but the notion of a public-private partnership, it wasn't just a private organization that could criticize the city, it would be a partnership with the city working to improve the park.
You open the book with Mayor Lindsay's appointment of Thomas Hoving as Parks Commissioner in 1965. What was the approach to managing Central Park at that point? Why was it so detrimental to the park?
Well, this was, I call it the anything goes era. And Tom Hoving, it was just great. He wanted, well, one thing, a polo field on the Great Lawn, okay. And he also, nothing about graffiti was wrong. I mean, it was great.
And they had happenings, right?
Happenings, and be-ins, and protest marches, love-ins. I mean, this was the 60s, remember? And Central Park was the place where it all took place.
So you describe that sort of period of anything goes. How were the city budget cuts making things even worse during that period for the park?
Well, what happened was the city budget cuts affected the park The Conservancy had a piece of paper from Mayor Koch saying that the city would not cut back on its budget just because we were raising money. But that was maybe as good as the paper it was written on. And the Conservancy, however, was the citizens of New York who really stepped up, and they got the message. And I think they got the message because between 1982 and 85, we prepared, I don't like the word master plan, we prepared a management and restoration plan.
Right.
And that word management's very important. You can't restore without managing. And so that's what gave us the impetus to raise money. And because the private sector was generous, we were able to move forward.
And that word management is very important too, because it establishes that this is an ongoing process. It's not about a single transformative moment, but it's ongoing.
It was just wonderful today, being in the park for my morning walk, and it's so great that these people who have had their lives, careers, working in Central Park, they still recognize me. And so there was a zone gardener. Now think how important that is. Somebody in every zone of the park now.
Right.
So the park was clean. There was nothing. This was Memorial Day yesterday, and there was no garbage on the ground. And the horticulture gets care. And so that is really the secret, I think, of management success.
Helps create pride in the place. I'm D.W. Gibson, speaking with Elizabeth Barlow Rogers about her book, Saving Central Park, A History and a Memoir, published by Knopf. So back up a little bit and tell us a little bit more about the creation of Central Park in 1858. How did the idea for a park in the middle of the city come about?
Well, you have to know that this is the first purpose-built people's park probably in the world. You had the royal parks open to the people. In England, you had the Tuileries, you had the Luxembourg in Paris. So, but this was built for the people. So the champions in the 19th century of Central Park, there is real civic pride there. We want to have a city that is a great metropolis. They're growing very fast. And so to set aside land around the central reservoir, the reservoir had been constructed,
right,
and opened in 1842. Great public health victory. So then they had a design competition, and Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Vaux won the design competition.
So at what point did you realize that private support would be essential to the future of the park? You know, you've really underscored the idea of the private-public partnership. When did you realize that would be the key?
Well, I mentioned the task force. Well, any organization that you have, one of the great things about this city and this country is we have lots of not-for-profit organizations. In other countries, they depend more on government support. And so I knew that the Central Park Task Force had to raise money. So it was incorporated as a 501c3 not-for-profit organization. So the idea for the Conservancy, it was already there that it had to be one too if it was going to raise money.
Right. You detail some of the greatest challenges that you face from the city administrators and private individuals. How did the Conservancy become a target of a vicious campaign by a bird watchers?
Yes,
that.
And me, thinking I'm a naturalist and out there with my binoculars, too. Well, that is a saga, it's a story of 1982, when we're beginning to really start to implement this great vision. You can't bring back the 19th century park exactly, but you can bring back the spirit of Olmsted and Calvert Vaux, the collaborators.
Right.
And it was all about views and view lines and scenic opportunities. So my great landscape architectural colleague at the time, Bruce Kelly, in a southern accent, said, well, if we just open up, you know, this view to the Belvedere, you know, we just cut down just a few of these self-seated cherry trees, and there are plenty of others, you know, and oh my God. So that was a great lesson in community relations.
Right.
And so if you go in the, we had to back off. This was a terrible thing. It was in the front page of the New York Times. And so, but I hung in there, as they say, after I had been accused of committing arboricide. I didn't lose my job. I kept on, and there was a big park outside of the Ramble, and we kept restoring the park itself, all of it. And now the Ramble, where I was this morning, has been restored by the Conservancy. There is a Woodland Management Committee. It has been done with lots of constituency support. The migratory birds have just finished coming through. Bird watchers galore are there, including me. You know, it's really become a little paradise there in the middle of Central Park.
Right. And so let's talk about Strawberry Fields, the memorial there too. Why was getting that established such a challenge?
Well, again, I was working with Bruce. I got Yoko Ono's lawyer came to my office, and as a matter of courtesy, he was saying, we're running an ad in the New York Times, and it will say, Nations of the World, send us your trees, your, you know, artifacts, fountains, and so forth, and we will build a Garden of Peace. And I said, well, Frederick Law Olmsted, and we have this plan. And Yoko, she was really great. She says, Japanese people like simplicity. So we like nature. So we, Bruce and I, went to see Yoko, and he and she worked together. And this is really, you might look at it as the implementation of the first piece of that management and restoration plan. Very important. She gave $1 million. 600,000 went in the ground for the restoration. 400 created an endowment for our first zone gardener.
Oh, wow.
That was important.
So got that very vital staffing started.
That's right.
By the time you left your position in 1995, the Conservancy had donated more than $100 million of private money to restoring the park. What did you learn about leadership and saving an urban park over the course of your tenure? What were the sort of foundational takeaways from you for you?
Well, you have to think of it this way. Basically, I had the role of an entrepreneur. It was my vision, and I was able to begin the implementation, start to build the structure of management. But ongoing administration and the growth of a large organization was, I was learning, I was given consultants to coach me as I took on more of those skills of a CEO. However, I felt that the park by this time was really in, you know, when the time has come, when your skills, you've achieved something, but new skills can take it to a new level. And that's what was done. And I have to mention here Douglas Blonsky, who's just stepped down as the CEO and president of the Central Park Conservancy, undoubtedly the best park manager in America, if not the world.
You know, your book, it seems to be about many things and has wonderful pictures of the park at various stages throughout its history. But I have to say, something that stood out to me as central about the book is, as New Yorkers, we're really good at complaining about things and talking about the change we want to see, but you embody the spirit of making that change happen. And I think the city has a lot of gratitude for that. Thank you so much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.